Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What have we learned about the nature of the universe over the past year? Scientists in 2012 made a number of fascinating discoveries about stars, black holes, and supernovas, and they cheered the safe landing of the rover Curiosity on the surface of Mars. My guest today has covered all those stories and more, and he is here today to talk about his picks for top 10 astronomy stories of 2012. Ken Croswell earned his PhD in astronomy from Harvard and now writes about science and space for a number of print and online publications. You can find links to his work online at kencroswell.com. Ken, welcome back to Think.
Good afternoon, Chris.
Was 2012 a particularly exciting year for space news?
Well, I think most years are, and this year has been no exception. I consider the number one story of the year to be the discovery of a planet similar in mass to the Earth going around the very closest star system to the Sun, Alpha Centauri. This is a remarkable discovery and a remarkable star system because most stars are not similar to the Sun. Most stars are fainter, cooler, and smaller, called red dwarfs. And we have serious doubts as to whether a red dwarf can support a life-bearing planet because they give off so little light. In contrast, we do know that a star like the Sun can support a life-bearing planet because here we are going around, living on a wonderful planet, going around a star that is yellow and bright and gives off abundant energy. And the remarkable thing about the Alpha Centauri system is that it contains two stars that are rather similar to the Sun. Most stars are not similar to the Sun. Only about 4% of all stars in the Milky Way galaxy have the same yellow color as the Sun. But the Alpha Centauri system contains a star that has exactly the same yellow color as the Sun, the same surface temperature as the Sun, the same G2 spectral type as the Sun. And we call the star, which is the brightest in the system, Alpha Centauri A. And then the second star in the Alpha Centauri system is an orange star, somewhat fainter, somewhat cooler than the Sun, and we call it Alpha Centauri B. And it's around that star that an Earth-mass planet was discovered in 2012. And then there's a third star in the Alpha Centauri system called Proxima Centauri that is one of these red dwarf stars, one of these little red stars that may not give off enough energy for life. But the discovery of the planet around Alpha Centauri B, I consider the top story in astronomy for the entire year. This is an Earth-mass planet. It's not a planet, you know, it's not one of these big bloated gas giants like Jupiter and Saturn that nobody can live on. This is a planet that has about the same mass as the Earth. Now, before you start to pack your bags for this planet, you should know one thing. It's probably a really, really nasty planet, despite its similarity in mass to the Earth. And that's because it's 9 times closer to its Sun than Mercury is to our Sun.
So hot, hot, hot.
It's very hot on its day side and very cold on its night side because it's so close to its star that the tides from the star have forced one side to permanently face the star and the other side to permanently face away. Now, here in our solar system, Mercury takes 88 days to go around the Sun, and during the daytime, it gets up to about 800 degrees Fahrenheit, and during the nighttime, it gets hundreds of degrees below zero. Well, this planet is so close to its star that it takes just 3 days, 5 hours, and 40 minutes to complete an orbit, and I anticipate that the day side of this planet is probably thousands of degrees Fahrenheit, and the night side is hundreds of degrees below zero. Now, the good news, though, is one thing we have learned is that in solar systems that have one Earth-mass planet, normally they have more than one Earth-mass planet. In fact, you can look at our own solar system. We have, you know, the Earth is obviously an Earth-mass planet. Venus, right next door, is a planet very similar in mass to the Earth. And we find the same pattern in other solar systems as well. So the hope is that even though, you know, nobody lives on this planet around Alpha Centauri, the hope is that Alpha Centauri has other planets similar in mass to the Earth that are located farther out, that have cooler climates, and who knows, maybe one of those planets could have some form of life on a sufficiently warm and wet world in the Alpha Centauri system. Alpha Centauri is just, you know, it's just a little over 4 light-years away, so it'd be absolutely fascinating to think that the nearest life forms could be that close to us in the galaxy.
So another big story from this past year, Ken, is the successful arrival of the latest Mars rover. Tell us about what Curiosity can do that its predecessors could not.
Well, yes, this was a very big story of the year. The Curiosity lander marks the eighth attempt by NASA to land on Mars and the seventh success. The very first successful landers were 1976, the Viking 1 and Viking 2 landers, and they told us a lot about the surface of Mars. They took wonderful photographs of Mars, but they were stationary. That was the problem. We always wanted to see what lay right beyond that horizon in those photographs. Well, starting in 1997, NASA began landing rovers on the surface of Mars. So they landed in one place and then moved elsewhere so they could get a fuller view of the surface of Mars. And Mars Curiosity, which landed on August 6th, is the largest rover yet put on the planet Mars. And the hope is that it's going to tell us something about the past of the planet Mars, because today Mars is a very cold world, very dry world, but billions of years ago, probably about 4 billion years ago, we have evidence that Mars was a warmer and wetter planet. When we look at the ancient terrain of Mars, we actually see dried up riverbeds. And so that's a suggestion that Mars had a much more pleasant climate back then than it does now. And the question is, how much warmer and how much wetter was Mars back then? And did some form of life arise at that time? Those are the big questions that the Mars Curiosity lander may be answering.
So everybody was all spun up a couple of weeks ago that there appeared to perhaps be some organic compounds found in Martian sand. Give us some perspective on what that could mean and what it doesn't necessarily mean.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean there was ever life on Mars. Organic does not necessarily mean produced by life. Organic is a term that chemists use to describe certain molecules, and they don't necessarily have anything to do with life. For example, Saturn's largest moon, Titan, has an atmosphere that contains methane. Well, methane is an organic molecule, but that doesn't mean there's anybody on Titan that's producing that molecule. In the case of Curiosity, it has found what is probably carbon on Mars, but that's hardly a surprise because carbon is the fourth most common element in the universe. I'd be absolutely shocked if there weren't carbon on Mars. So no one should get the view that, oh yeah, this means there's life on Mars. No, it's going to take a lot more work on the part of Curiosity to figure out whether or not there ever was life on Mars, and we may not even succeed in that task. But the real point is to try to figure out the ancient past of Mars and to see how much warmer and wetter the planet once was.
I mean, obviously, Mars is, relatively speaking, easy for us to get to.
Yes.
I mean, is our obsession with Mars about learning a little more about why the Earth ended up the lucky sister of the two?
Well, that is certainly part of the motivation, because right now we know of only one planet in the entire universe that has got life, and we're living on it. The question is, the really big question is, are we alone in the universe, or are there lots of other planets out there where life arose? I strongly suspect that there are, in fact, we know that there are other Earth-sized planets out there, and I strongly suspect that some of them, simply by virtue of being located the right distance from their suns, are going to have the right temperature, and they're going to have water, they're going to have atmospheres, they're going to have all the right conditions that ought to spawn life. But that doesn't mean that life ever developed. It may be that the development of life is something that happens so incredibly rarely that it only occurred on one planet in the entire universe. Or it may be something that's so easy, given enough time, that it can happen anywhere where the conditions are right. Mars may be able to tell us which of those two very radically different possibilities is true, because if life arose on Mars, independent of life on Earth, that means that the same thing happened someplace else, and if it happened on two planets, well, it surely happened on trillions of other planets throughout the galaxy. And that means we probably have a lot of company in space.
If you had to put $20 down on this bet, which side would you land on?
Well, I honestly don't know. We have absolutely no data. It's extremely difficult to extrapolate from one example. I mean, remember, before we discovered any planets going around other stars, we thought that other solar systems would be very similar to our own. And now we're finding so many of these solar systems out there are the complete opposite of ours. I mean, our solar system has the small planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, close to the star, and then the big planets like Jupiter and Saturn far away from the star. Well, a lot of the solar systems out there are just the opposite to our shock. They've got big planets very close to their stars. So you asked me, do I think that life may have developed or did develop on Mars? I guess if you twisted my arm and forced me, I'd probably say yes, but I honestly don't know. I mean, some people think that even though Mars was once warmer and wetter in the past, it may never have gotten any better than modern Antarctica. Hmm. Okay, so Mars may never have been as nice a planet as the Earth. On the other hand, there are other people that go to the opposite extreme and say, oh yeah, Mars had oceans. You know, the northern hemisphere of Mars was once an ocean. So we just don't know, and that's part of the job of Curiosity and other spacecraft to find out.
Back for just a minute to our discussion about the planet orbiting Alpha Centauri B. We have an email from Steve who says, do you foresee a time in the future where we might get measurement for topography of that planet so that a computer could visualize its surface? Because, Steve writes, that would be cool.
That would be very cool, yes. We would like to know as much about that planet as we can. The next thing, to answer Steve's question directly, I don't think discovering the topography of that planet is going to be possible anytime soon. The very next thing that's going to happen is that during 2013, the Hubble Space Telescope is going to be used to search for eclipses that this planet causes of its star. If the planet's orbit is oriented correctly so that it's in our line of sight, then every 3 days and 5 hours, it's going to pass in front of its star, and we'll be able to detect that eclipse with the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, there's only about a 10% chance that the orbit is oriented right, but if it is oriented right, we'll be able to figure out how big the planet is, and from that, we'll know how dense it is, and from that, we can guess what its composition is. But I think it's going to be a long time before we know the details of things like its topography. Someday, of course, we would love to send a spacecraft there, an unmanned spacecraft, to Alpha Centauri, but Alpha Centauri is 7,000 times farther than Pluto. In fact, I have an article that's going to appear in the February 2013 issue of Earth Magazine, which is a high-quality geology magazine, but they're very interested in the geology of other worlds, and I point out in the final paragraph that Alpha Centauri is 7,000 times farther than Pluto, and we have not yet explored Pluto. So it's going to be a long time before we know more about that planet.
And little Pluto is starting to remind me like of one of the Olsen twins, very small thing that will not stay out of the news. This year we learned it has another moon.
Yes, that's right, Pluto. Pluto, and there's a delicious aspect of this story. This moon was discovered by the Hubble Space Telescope by astronomers who in 2006 signed a petition saying they would ignore the demotion of Pluto and continue to regard Pluto as a planet. So Pluto now has five moons that we know about. The first was discovered back in 1978, and we now know of five altogether. And remarkably, all five of them are in resonance with one another. In other words, if you take a look at the innermost moon of Pluto, which is the one closest to Pluto, it's the largest one, all the other four are orbit in simple multiples. For example, the next one out takes three times longer to go around than that innermost moon. The next one takes four times, and so forth. So even though we here on Earth may not be in harmony, the moons of Pluto are in total harmony with each other.
My guest is Ken Croswell. He is an astronomer and writer of science. We're talking this hour about the top 10 astronomy stories of 2012. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program and Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour about the top 10 astronomy stories of 2012, according to my guest, writer and astronomer Ken Croswell. You can learn more about his work and find links to his various articles at kencroswell.com. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let me make sure that I have this straight, Ken. When we're talking about Pluto and its largest moon, those two sort of waltz around each other, and then the other moons are in concentric circles around those two. Is that right?
That's basically right, yes. The other four moons go around the center of mass of the Pluto-Charon system. That large moon is called Charon. It was discovered in 1978. And one of the other stories of this year, which actually appeared before the discovery of the fifth moon, was that astronomers did a computer simulation of the Pluto-Moon system and came up with some deductions. And one of the more interesting deductions is that they say, you know what, those other four moons are kind of like planets going around a double star. And, in fact, last year, one of the top stories of astronomy was the discovery of the first planet going around a double star. And it turns out that according to the computer simulations of Pluto's moons, that we should expect that planets going around double stars should probably be more widely separated from one another than our planets, like in our solar system, that go around a single star. And that's simply because there's a jostling caused by the two stars at the center of the solar system. So that's a prediction that that work makes. We have not yet discovered more than one planet going around any one double star, but I suspect such a discovery might occur in 2013 or 2014, and we can then test whether indeed planets going around double stars are more spaced out than planets in our solar system.
What would day and night seem like if you were going around a double star? Would it sort of get light and dark and light and dark?
Well, you would, if you lived on this planet, you would see two suns in your sky, and then you basically would have two sunrises and two sunsets, but they would follow each other pretty fast. So you would still experience a night, but your day would be doubly illuminated. And I guess if the two stars are similar in brightness, you're going to see double shadows. In other words, you aren't going to see the same sharp shadows we see here on Earth.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Omar in Dallas. Hi, Omar.
Hi, how are you doing? Long-time listener, great show. And I just had a comment for your guest. As he was describing how meticulous it is for life to really flourish on any planet, it's very, it's not as easy as it seems, obviously. And I was wondering if people in this field are a little more environmentally conscious. I do believe in global warming, so I don't know if your guest is a believer in that, but just knowing how hard it is for life to flourish on a planet, I was wondering if they take that into consideration.
Interesting question.
Well, yes, I think one of the big lessons of our space program, if you look back over the last half century, is that, you know, there's only one good planet in the solar system, and we live on it. There were times when people thought that there might be life on Venus, life on Mars. Remember the days of Percival Lowell back in the 1890s and early 1900s, he thought there was intelligent life on Mars. Well, the problem is all the other planets out there, even Mars, which is the best of them, they're very hostile compared to the Earth. And I think definitely one thing we ought to appreciate and one lesson that the space program has told us is how very precious this planet is. And yes, we have got to take care of it. There's no question about that. I don't foresee us moving en masse to any other planet out there.
So we had evidence this year of a black hole at the center of a very distant galaxy sort of tearing apart a star that strayed too close to it. First of all, what did that look like? Because this was, am I correct, a star that we couldn't see until it started to be destroyed.
That's exactly right. It's only in death that this star shone up so brightly that we could see it across 2.1 billion light years of space. Most Most galaxies, including our own, most large galaxies, have giant black holes at their centers. And in fact, the black hole at the center of this galaxy seems to be quite similar to the one at the center of our galaxy. And as this black hole tore apart this poor star that strayed too close to it, it heated its remains enormously, so it sent out an enormous flare of light, and it was the detection of that flare that gave away what was going on. And this flare lasted for over a year, which so it was not at all like an exploding star. We do occasionally see exploding stars or supernovae in other galaxies, but this flare was very different. And what's remarkable, too, not only the event of a black hole swallowing a star, but also astronomers were able, from the observations, to figure out a lot about this star. And in particular, they discovered very strong lines in the spectrum of helium, but no hydrogen. And that's very unusual because hydrogen is more common than helium. And so they deduced that the star was made mostly of helium with no hydrogen. And their best guess is that it was a red giant star that was stripped of its hydrogen. A typical red giant has hydrogen on the outside and helium on the inside. And the thinking is that as the star approached the black hole, and when it was about as far from the black hole as Pluto is from the sun, that the gravity of the black hole tore off that hydrogen, that outer hydrogen envelope, and left it with just the helium. And then as the star got to be about as close to the black hole as Mercury is to the sun, well, then the black hole moved in for the kill and started gobbling the helium and tore it to shreds.
What might have happened to the surrounding stars and other things in the neighborhood when this large presence of this star was sucked away?
Well, I would guess that, since we were able to detect it from 2.1 billion light years, any stars in the vicinity and their planets would have received a pretty strong dose of radiation and probably gotten heated a bit. But that would be quite a dramatic sight if you were in that galaxy where that was actually happening. Now, there's something that's much smaller scale that is probably going to happen next summer in our galaxy. Last year, astronomers discovered a gas cloud that is approaching the black hole at the center of our galaxy and apparently is going to collide with that black hole sometime next summer. So it's going to be very interesting to see what will happen. Now, this cloud is much, much smaller, much less massive than the star, so the fireworks are not going to be nearly as dramatic, but astronomers will, of course, be watching carefully to see what the details will be.
And what's all this about scientists sort of modeling and discovering that Earth could withstand a strike from a very, very miniature black hole?
That's right, yeah. Every now and then people ask me, well, what would happen if the Earth collides with a black hole? And I say, well, you know, black holes, you know, big black holes, normal black holes, the black holes we think of out there, are so rare and so widely separated from us that the chance of that happening is virtually zero. However, some scientists have proposed that right after the Big Bang, right after the birth of the universe, small regions of the universe may have collapsed into what are called primordial black holes. And as you say, these are very small black holes. They have about the mass of an asteroid, but the diameter of an atomic nucleus.
That's amazing. Wait, we have to take a second to think about those. Say that again. Mass of an asteroid, diameter of an atomic nucleus. That's a lot packed into a very, very tiny amount of space.
Indeed it is, and that's what black holes do. I actually devote an entire chapter in my book, The Lives of Stars, to black holes. And black holes have so much gravity, and they're so dense, and that nothing, not even light, can escape them. So in size, they're not that big, but in mass, they can be incredible. So you're right, they've got the mass of an asteroid, but the diameter of an atomic nucleus. And if they exist, and nobody knows if these primordial black holes even exist, but if they do, they are probably very common, much more common than ordinary black holes, and they could constitute part of the dark matter in our galaxy. So scientists this year did some computer simulations of what would happen if one of these primordial black holes hit the Earth, because if they are very common, then they should hit the Earth every now and then. And the good news is, doomsday has been canceled. One of these primordial black holes hitting the Earth is not going to ruin your whole day. these scientists found that the black hole hits the Earth, it goes through the Earth in about a minute, comes out more or less the other side, and not that much happens. The world experiences a mild earthquake, maybe a magnitude 4 earthquake, and the difference between a normal earthquake is that a normal earthquake is localized. For example, we have one here in California, you're not going to feel it there in Texas. This is, however, an earthquake that everybody would feel, but it'd be a very mild earthquake. So I think we have nothing to worry about from a collision with a primordial black hole. That's the good news.
Assuming it doesn't, like, hit our car or something first, is that right?
Well, exactly. chances are it would come down to the ocean or some unpopulated place.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Shahid in Irving. Hi, Shahid.
Hi, Chris, and hi. Thanks to your guests for a great conversation. What I want to ask is that, we know the basic ingredients of life by studying it here on Earth, like, you know, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, carbon, all that, right? Is there a way that we can ourselves take those basic ingredients, knowledge, and propel life in other hostile environments, even at a limited capacity, but are we able to do that?
Do you mean, are we able ourselves, as scientists, to create life in the laboratory from unliving material?
Exactly, and then can we take that knowledge and, for example, build a lab on Moon or Mars and basically propel the life within those environments somehow?
So terraforming is essentially what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have never been able to create life in the laboratory, if that was your question. In fact, in the 1950s, scientists did try to subject elements such as you're talking about, oxygen, hydrogen, and so forth, to lightning charges in the hope that maybe they could spark some form of life, but that didn't happen. So we've never been able to create life in the laboratory. However, in terms of actually terraforming a planet, in other words, making it a better place, we could simply import existing life from Earth to, let's say, Mars. Mars is certainly the most promising planet to do this, and over the centuries make it a more hospitable place. And in particular, in the case of Mars, probably one of the first things you'd want to do is you'd want to give it more atmosphere, because Mars has a very, very tenuous atmosphere. It's not even 1% the atmospheric pressure here on Earth. So you would want to think of some life form that generates lots of gas and export it to Mars and just let it go to work, and maybe a century or so later it'd be a better place to live.
Oh, okay, so let's go to other black hole news from the year. Astronomers found a truly gigantic black hole in a relatively small galaxy. Why is that so unusual, and what could the explanation be for that?
Well, yeah, this was quite a surprise to everyone, including the astronomer who made the discovery. I interviewed him a few weeks ago, and he said, I never expected to find such a big black hole in such a small galaxy. He was expecting big black holes in big galaxies. That's the normal pattern. This is one of the biggest black holes ever found. It's either the biggest or the second biggest known. It's got 17 billion times as much mass as the Sun. And normally you'd expect such a big black hole to reside in a really big galaxy, but this one resides in a galaxy smaller than the Milky Way. Its name is NGC 1277, lies in the constellation Perseus. It's part of a galaxy cluster in that constellation. 230 million light years away, and nobody that I talk with knew how it got there, why it violates this basic rule between basically galaxy size and black hole mass. But the same astronomers who made this discovery are also looking at a few other galaxies that may likewise violate this correlation, in other words, having a much bigger black hole at their centers than they should.
And I was thinking maybe it had once had a lot of different objects in it and then gobbled them up, but they're thinking maybe when the black hole was being formed, somehow it failed to attract a lot of objects within its galaxy?
Yeah, that's the question. Which is the unusual thing? Is this a black hole that just failed to attract the rest of its galaxy, or is the galaxy unusual and being just small and giving birth to a really big black hole? We don't know which is the unusual thing. In other words, is the black hole too big or is the galaxy too small? Which is it? We don't yet know.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Tony on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Tony.
Yes, hello. Hello.
Hi.
Yes, okay. Your comment, and thank you. There is a lot of information that the NASA, you know, NASA, a lot of information since 1940, 1945, 1948, because this is like a conspiracy about the space or extraterrestrial or intraterrestrial information. And do you know who is John Keel? John Keel has a lot of information. And then my conclusion is that the government and NASA, they don't want to educate the population, because there are a lot. This is like a conspiracy. There is a lot of secrecy, because.
Do you think? We sort of lost Tony there, but I guess there are some people out there who feel like NASA is a conspiracy. My sense is that you feel pretty confident in the work NASA is doing.
That's right, and I'm not entirely sure what Tony thinks NASA is trying to cover up, but you know, it's in NASA's best interest to publicize discoveries about the universe. I don't understand why NASA would want to cover anything up. And furthermore, you know, in a free country, it's a little hard to cover things up for very long periods of time. Just look at all the politicians and all their various scandals. Those things don't get covered up very well. And I would think, you know, if NASA has made some great discovery about, let's say, Mars, they found life on Mars, why on earth would they want to cover it up? I don't understand it. In fact, on the contrary, if NASA ever succeeds in finding, let's say, a fossil of life on Mars, I think that would motivate additional missions for NASA. So it's actually in NASA's best interest to do just the opposite.
Especially because they are fighting harder than ever for continued funding.
That's right, exactly.
We are speaking this hour with writer and astronomer Ken Croswell. We're talking about the top 10 astronomy stories of 2012 as he's identified them. If you've got a question, want to make a nomination of your top story of the year, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. And you can learn more about Ken's work at kencroswell, kencroswell.com. Back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and astronomer Ken Croswell. We're talking about his top 10 astronomy stories of 2012. You can join us by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Ken, what did we learn this year about how some stars can capture and potentially release planets?
Yes, study that was done in an attempt to explain really far-out planets. And when I say far-out planet, I mean a planet that orbits much farther from its star than Pluto does to our Sun. Such planets should not exist, according to conventional theory, because we think that planets, including those going around the Sun, form from a disk of gas and dust that once went around the very young Sun. And then those planets arose from that disk, and that's why most of them are still in the same plane, because it's the plane of that original disk. But you don't expect to form planets beyond the edge of that disk. And so we observe these disks going around many young stars, and they tend to be about the same size as Neptune's orbit or Pluto's orbit, so something like that. And so to find planets that are, you know, dozens of times farther out than Pluto is from the Sun is really quite a surprise. And this new study may explain this. It recognizes that most stars form with other stars, and in particular, many stars form in star clusters, with hundreds or thousands of other stars. And in the process of a star giving birth to its planets, the various planets can interact with one another and kick planets out of their home solar system. But as long as there are other stars nearby, one of those other stars can capture this lost planet. And in this computer study, it was found that, as you would expect, these captured planets tended to have very large orbits, orbiting maybe hundreds or thousands of times farther from their stars than the Earth does from the Sun. So this idea may explain the existence of these very far-out planets located very far from their suns.
And sometimes they can actually be orbiting in the opposite direction of all the other planets within the solar system.
That's right. All of the planets in our solar system orbit in the same direction. If you were north of the plane of our solar system and looked down, you would see all the planets going around the sun counterclockwise. However, and that's because that disk that was going around the young sun was spinning in the same direction, so the planets naturally formed with motions that resemble that of the original disk. However, when a star captures a planet, it can be captured in any direction. So about half the time, the planet should go around the star in the same direction that the other planets do, and about the other half of the time, though, it's going to go around backwards, opposite the direction from the other planets.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jim's on the line next in Fort Worth. Hey, Jim.
Chris, how are you? Again, thanks for joining us today.
I'm very happy to be here.
Hey, I'm going to give you the chance to move a little bit from fact to fancy. I would like to know your personal favorite science fiction book and movie where the selection criteria is that they are reasonably accurate, but they also stretch our credulity and our thought processes.
Well, I've always been a big fan of the original Star Trek series. Okay, I thought that that series made an attempt to be accurate. Obviously, faster than light travel is, as far as we know, not possible. But I think they made an attempt to be accurate. I think many of the shows were quite thought provoking. You know, I mean, they raise large philosophical issues. So I would have to give my vote to Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have another email here that asks, is it true an asteroid will pass our planet at a near distance as close as the moon's orbit in the near future?
I can confidently say yes, because it happens every now and then. In fact, just a few days ago it happened. An asteroid came closer to us than is the moon. Fortunately, it didn't hit us. But every now and then, yeah, one of these asteroids does pass rather close to the Earth. What we astronomers would like to do is simply to find everything that's out there, and so then calculate whether or not there's ever going to be an impact, you know, say decades in the future. We don't at this time know of any asteroid that is on a collision course with the Earth, and that's the good news. The bad news is we don't know of everything that's out there. If someday we do find something that will in the far future collide with us, then we'll have enough time to launch a space mission and do something about it.
So this year, a really, really distant spiral galaxy was discovered. What's so special about a spiral structure near the edge of the universe?
Well, spiral galaxies are the most beautiful galaxies in the universe. Now, I admit I'm prejudiced. I was born in a spiral galaxy named the Milky Way. I believe you were too.
We've got that in common, yes.
Yes. So, nevertheless, even if I were born in one of the elliptical galaxies of the universe, I think I would be sufficiently unbiased to say that, you know, the spirals are the most beautiful. They look like glowing celestial hurricanes. And when we look at the nearby universe, the modern universe, we find that about two-thirds of bright galaxies are spirals. However, it takes a fair amount of order in a galaxy in order to create that spiral pattern. And when we look at very large distances, and thus very far back in time, we are looking to a time when galaxies were much more turbulent and had not yet settled down and were unable to create a spiral pattern. And so galaxies at the edge of the universe are, you know, they look like featureless blobs, and you don't expect to see a beautiful spiral galaxy. And yet this year, astronomers did discover a spiral galaxy located 10.7 billion light years from Earth. So it, we're seeing it as it was when it was just 3 billion years old, or rather when the universe was 3 billion years old. And it's a bit of a mystery as to how, at that time, when galaxies were so turbulent, how this one was able to produce a spiral pattern. I talked with a couple of astronomers about this. One said, well, maybe, in fact, the discoverer said that his theory was that this galaxy has a companion galaxy that goes around it, and it may be stirring up spiral structure in the main galaxy. But another astronomer said, no, he didn't think that was the reason, that maybe this galaxy has so much gas, the gravity of that gas overwhelms the turbulence and gives rise to the spiral structure. But either way, this is a record-breaking galaxy. It's the farthest spiral galaxy ever seen.
And, of course, we have no way of knowing what it looks like at this moment.
That's right. 10.7 billion years of time have gone by, and so today we don't know if it's still a spiral, or maybe it's collided with some other galaxy that has ruined its spiral structure. The same thing, by the way, is going to happen to us in a few billion years. We're going to collide with the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the nearest large galaxy. It's also a spiral, and the two spirals will tear themselves asunder, and likely we will ultimately emerge as a giant elliptical galaxy, a much bigger galaxy, but unfortunately much less beautiful.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Sharon on the line next in Dallas. Hey, Sharon.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a question. Everyone seems to assume, even scientists, that all living forms are carbon and hydrogen-based. Would it not be possible for life to be formed from some other element, maybe known as a universe, maybe not even known, that would not require water and the temperatures that we require being carbon-based?
Yes, scientists have thought of that possibility. All life that we know of here on Earth is carbon-based, and some scientists have suggested, and not just scientists, but science fiction writers have suggested, that maybe you can have silicon-based life. Silicon is in the same column of the periodic table as carbon, and so maybe it's a bit similar to carbon. Well, there's a problem with this idea, and the problem is there's actually far more silicon on Earth than there is carbon. So if there were any place for silicon-based life to arise, it surely would be Earth, and yet all the life here on Earth is carbon-based. And there's a second problem with silicon-based life, and that is it has a very nasty tendency, silicon has a very nasty tendency to form rocks with oxygen, which is the most common element in the Earth's crust. So for those reasons, I suspect that all life in the universe is carbon-based, that carbon is just a wonderful atom from which you can form very long chains of molecules. Now, Sharon also asked about, is water really a requirement? Here on Earth, water is a requirement. Some people have speculated that maybe you can have other liquids, for example, methane on much colder planets. Methane is a liquid, and it also can be a gas and a solid as well. In fact, there's an object in our solar system, Titan, which is the largest moon of Saturn, where methane is in all these various states. But I'm more open to the possibility of life using methane rather than water than I am to non-carbon-based life. I really think you need carbon to have life.
It turns out, though, there is a whole lot of water in the universe, right?
Water is simply H2O, hydrogen and oxygen, and those are the two most common reactive elements in the universe. And so it's not a surprise that we see water in a number of places. It's obviously here on Earth. It's in frozen form on Mars. The rings of Saturn are made of water ice. There's water ice on Pluto. There's water ice on most of the moons of the outer solar system. So water is a rather common thing. Life, though, may be a rather rare thing. We don't yet know.
1-800-933-5372, our number. Let's check in with Weldon in Dallas. Hi, Weldon.
Hi. I love the black holes and that kind of stuff, but my question was, or thought was, is I understand that the black holes, as they travel through the universe, are sort of like vacuum cleaners. So I was wondering, if one of these microscopic black holes hit the Earth, wouldn't it get bigger as it went through? And how much bigger?
Ah, good question. Well, these primordial black holes only have the masses of asteroids. And according to this study, one thing I didn't mention a few minutes ago was that if they exist in large numbers, we're only going to get hit once every few million years. So, yes, over time, if you could somehow stop the impact of the black hole, and if it were to stay with the Earth, it would increase the Earth's mass. However, in this study, they found that the black hole just zips right through the Earth in about a minute. So we don't actually gain any mass from the accumulation of these black holes.
Let's go next on the phone to Samantha in Arlington. Hi, Samantha.
Hi. I just wanted to, my son is 8 years old, and he is fascinated by black holes. He watches the Through the Wormhole with on the Science Channel,
mm-hmm.
and so he knows way more about this than I do. But I'm trying to encourage him, and I'm wondering if our guest knows any age-appropriate books or ways I can encourage him in learning about the universe and astronomy and everything.
Thanks for your call.
That's a wonderful question. I myself got interested in astronomy at the age of 7 back in first grade, and I well remember being that age and just being fascinated by other planets and stars. And well, they didn't really have black holes back then, but I myself am the astronomy consultant for Highlights for Children, and I write for Highlights for Children astronomy articles. So that is certainly one magazine you might want to look into. Another possibility, if I may advertise myself, my latest book, The Lives of Stars, is all about how stars are born, how they live, how they die. It includes a chapter on black holes, and it's perfect for kids, probably 8 or 9 and above. But your son sounds quite advanced, so he might make his way through this book quite nicely. And even if he doesn't understand every single word, I can assure you the images in the book are absolutely stunning, all in color, all very beautiful.
Yeah, it's amazing the kinds of pictures that we can take now of things that we only imagined existing a couple of decades ago.
Yes, yes. The Hubble Space Telescope has done wonders for astronomical imagery, and we have some really high-quality telescopes on Earth. For example, there's a telescope in Chile called the VLT, which you'll be pleased to know stands for the Very Large Telescope, and it took some of the stunning color images in The Lives of Stars as well. But the Hubble Space Telescope made a great contribution to the book. There's no question about that.
Any sense of what 2013 might hold?
I suspect many surprises. I don't know, but that's part of what makes astronomy fascinating. I expect that the Hubble Space Telescope will be looking for this planet around Alpha Centauri. The hope is that that its orbit is aligned right so that it will pass in front of its star. If that happens, then we should know a lot more about its size, its composition, and maybe even if it has an atmosphere, because the starlight will be shining through the planet's atmosphere. But I strongly suspect that if we have this conversation 12 months from now, the greatest discoveries of the year will be surprises, things that we did not anticipate.
Ken Croswell earned his PhD in astronomy from Harvard and now writes about science and space for a number of publications. You can find links to his work online at kencroswell.com. Ken, thanks again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have you.
You're very welcome, Chris. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Welcome back, Shelley. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.